Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. We're going to continue talking about music, but we're going to change gears a little bit and talk with classical music composer Carl Schimmel. He lives in Grinnell and is an associate professor of music at Illinois State University. His music has been performed all over the world, and he's recently been named a 2018 Guggenheim Fellow, an honor that will allow him to spend the next year focusing on his composition. And he is here with us now. Hello, Carl.
Hi, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I like your show very much.
Thanks a lot. Well, we'll play a little bit from one of your compositions in just a moment. But for people who are not familiar with your work, can you describe your genre to us?
Sure. Well, I'll do my best. That's a common question, and it's a difficult one to answer, I guess, because my music is mostly chamber music, but occasionally I write for orchestra or band or chorus, and I guess stylistically, I draw on a lot of the same great 20th century compositions that my peers do. Pieces like, Rite of Spring, or pieces by Bartok or Shostakovich. But I guess in general, my music tends to be sort of expressionist in a way, if that makes sense. So it tends to be a little bit goes to extremes, and there are sudden changes. But I also like to play with humor and have a little bit of playfulness in my music.
Well, let's listen to a little bit from a composition. This is called Roadshow for Otto, and we're going to listen to a little bit of Movement 2, The Clown Mandeville. All right, that was a little bit from the composition Roadshow for Otto, Movement 2, The Clown Mandeville. With me is the composer of that piece, Carl Schimmel. And Carl, Otto, that's called Roadshow for Otto. Otto's your son, right?
That's right, yeah. I started the piece when he was only about 6 or 7 months old. And my idea for the piece was in each of the short movements to depict him playing with a different toy, and these toys were all toys that are featured on Antiques Roadshow, so that's what kind of pulls them all together.
So they weren't toys that you actually had in your home. This was imagining your son playing with these toys.
Right, yeah, so toys that were on the show that I thought he would get a kick out of if we could have them in our home.
So that gives us a little bit of insight into your creative process. I mean, do you remember the moment of inspiration when this idea started to come together?
Well, yes. I started this piece when I was in residency at a place called Copeland House, which is a place. It's one of Aaron Copeland's homes, and they run a residency program there where composers can go and live by themselves for some period of time, and all they do is compose. So I just decided to write a piece for this small ensemble, and I was actually looking for ideas, and being a new father, I started thinking about writing a piece for my kids, and I ended up writing a piece called Roadshow for Thora, which is for my daughter, and
you have to be fair if you're going to
write.
Yeah,
exactly. And I don't know why I settled on the Antiques Roadshow idea. I think it just crossed my mind somehow, but I thought, well, that would be kind of neat to take some of these unique items that are featured on this show that, you know, we probably will never own, but I just thought it was kind of an interesting starting point, you know.
Yeah, let's listen to a little bit more. This one's from Movement 4, also from Roadshow for Auto. This one's called Camel and Monkey. Bit of Camel and Monkey from Roadshow for Otto. How old is Otto now?
He's 8 and a half.
What does he think of his Roadshow?
He likes it. Yeah, he's kind of, I mean, as you can probably imagine, a little bit more into some of the music that is on the radio,
right?
And stuff. But he likes it.
I want to talk a little bit about your path to becoming a composer, because looking at your background, it seems a little unlikely that we're talking about this today. You actually worked as an actuarial assistant for a while. You have a degree in math?
Yes. So my undergrad degree is in math and music. And after I got my master's in music composition, I just wanted to live in New York City for a while. So I spent 3 years in New York City and used my math degree just as a way of making a living in the city.
Was math a backup plan for you in studying music?
Basically, yes. I mean, I don't know about always, but from a pretty young age, I found that I was especially interested in, basically the creative arts, but that ended up being music. Although when I was very young, I was more of a writer. And then I also always had a love of math. So it was basically a backup plan, but it was one that I enjoyed, you know.
Right. Do you think that there's a relationship for you between math and how it works and music?
Yeah, definitely. You know, on the one hand, music being a creative art is seen as something that is perhaps not so cerebral. I mean, there's a lot of emotion behind most of the music that we enjoy listening to. But on the other hand, music relies so heavily on pattern that I think there is that connection. You know, mathematical patterns, you find those in nature and in music. And so I think that's probably the closest connection that I can think of. And it does show up somewhat in my music, and I've used math in my music more often when I was a student, you know, when math was fresher in my mind, I suppose. But
well, in listening to your music, I guess there are songs that I hear that sound mathematical, that have the patterns and stick with the patterns. Your music that I've heard also seems to, you seem to take a lot of delight in breaking a pattern.
Right, that's right, yeah. So like in that last piece, which I don't think of as particularly mathematical, but there's a clear rhythm and pattern that's sort of set up. But there's always these slight deviations. So for example, I might stretch out a section of music or cut it off. And in the first example that you played, there are frequent changes of mood and tempo because I'm imagining kind of these rushing ideas. It's all kind of imaginary and fantastical, whereas the second is a single idea. But the interruptions that come in the second example that you played, the camel and monkey,
mm-hmm.
are supposed to be kind of like the playful monkey interrupting the plodding of the camel.
You mentioned doing a retreat where you were focusing on music. You're an associate professor of music at Illinois State University. You live in Grinnell, so there's a lot of commuting, obviously,
right.
that's involved there. You also have two fairly young kids.
Right.
Where do you find the space, both mentally and physically, to compose right now?
Well, this year I'm on sabbatical. And
right.
so it just so happens that the fellowship that I just received will allow me to have one more year here in Grinnell with the family. It is a challenge, and we have kind of made it work because my wife, Mariko, who teaches at the college here in Grinnell, she teaches Japanese here. She's had a few sabbaticals, and I've had a few sabbaticals in some years that I've requested unpaid leave so that I could be with family. But, of course, as professors, we have summers off, so that's the time that I get a lot of my writing done, that time and also over winter break.
Well, and a lot of people are, of course, familiar with life in academia and the pressure to publish, to get your research out there. So as a professor of music, are your compositions getting a composition published? Is that your goal then? Is that what maybe success is measured by in the academic world?
Now most composers self-publish. The software and the technology has developed to the point where it's pretty straightforward to publish your own materials. So it's not so much publication, but performances, commissions, premieres. Of course, recognitions like the Guggenheim mm-hmm. go a long way in making a case that you deserve tenure, for example, which I already have tenure, but these are some of the things that administrations would look at when deciding whether a professor in my field would receive tenure.
How do you make connections with orchestras around the world? As I mentioned, your music has been performed around the world. Where do those connections come from? Is that something you need to seek out yourself, or are people searching for you?
It's a little of both. Making connections with orchestras is a special challenge because they have limited space in their programs for new music. There are so many talented composers out there. I don't suppose maybe it's something that the average listener to the program realizes, but there really are, hundreds of really great composers in this country who don't get much of an opportunity to have their music heard, especially their orchestral music. So I can speak to my own experience and the times that I've had my orchestral music performed. It's often through programs that orchestras have in place for finding young composers, typically, whose music they would like to feature. So, for example, I participated in something called the Minnesota Orchestra Composer Institute, and that's a special program that they have where they only play a collection of pieces by young composers. So those kinds of opportunities exist, and outside of that, it's kind of a crapshoot. you just send out your music and hope that somebody listens to it and enjoys it enough to contact you.
I want to play a little bit of another piece of yours. This is from Four Nocturnes from the Oblivion Haha. And can you give us a little bit of background on this?
Sure. Yeah. So this is one of my only works for voice and ensemble. And it's a setting of four poems from a collection called the Oblivion Haha by James Tate, he sadly passed away not too long ago, but he got his master's at the University of Iowa Writers' Workshop, and so there's kind of a connection there. But I just love his poetry. It's very fantastical and surreal. And I think that you'll be playing, is it Jim's All Night Diner?
Yeah.
Yeah, so this is just a kind of a strange, it's a great example of his writing where he paints a scene that is, it's hard to tell what's going on, but I think that the title of the poem gives you a hint that he's basically depicting this diner as a little world unto itself. And this is performed by Lucy Shelton, who's a New York soprano, with da capo chamber players.
All right, let's listen. So that was just a very short excerpt from the four nocturnes from the Oblivion, haha, and inspired by a poem by James Tate, which provided the lyrics for that. And we have just a moment left. So the next year is you're going to be focusing on composition. You also have some major performances coming up too, right?
Yeah, I have some performances coming up this summer. This week I have a premiere of a piece for viola and piano that I wrote for a composer and violist friend. His name's Kurt Rohde. He's going to be performing that on the West Coast and a few places in California. It's going to be played again in Rhode Island, which is where I grew up.
Oh, nice.
And also I have a premiere later in the summer also in Rhode Island at the Kingston Chamber Music Festival.
Well, exciting, and I hope you have really an incredible year with your Guggenheim Fellowship. Thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you, Charity.
Composer Carl Schimmel, he lives in Grinnell. He's an associate professor of music at Illinois State University, and he's been named a 2018 Guggenheim Fellow. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.